Well, thanks for downloading Farage Against the Machine, where I take on some controversial characters, some of whom I agree with, others of whom I don't, including this episode, which is with former Deputy Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and former leader of the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg. I ask him, is he happy that Trump is coming to visit the UK in July? What was it like working with now our current Prime Minister, Theresa May? And if he thought he could stop Brexit, would he return to frontline politics and maybe lead a new political party in the UK?
Thank you for coming on, Nick.
It's good to be on your podcast.
Now, I was on your podcast.
I know. This
which
is the return.
Makes it a pretty unusual.
I did say if you came on mine,
match.
I would come on yours. So, you know, I'm true to my word.
Donald Trump is coming to visit the United Kingdom. Going to be a four-day visit. We're not quite sure exactly where he's going to go yet. Do you welcome that news?
I don't think you can refuse a visit of the US president, but I'm not a fan of the US president.
No, I'd noticed that, but you're not quite in the Sadiq Khan, John Bercow camp. I mean, Bercow saying he should be banned from the parliamentary, buildings. Sadiq saying he's not welcome in London. Is this grown-up politics from Sadiq Khan?
I haven't seen what Sadiq Khan has said, but my instinct is that you can express your disagreement with him, your displeasure that he's being feted on whatever visit he comes on, and still, in a sense, accept that he is the President of the United States and is therefore entitled to, you know, to visit the United Kingdom. I've never believed in the idea that you impose sort of fatwas on communicating with people you disagree with. If that was the case, I don't think I'd be sitting here right now.
Well,
I mean,
you formed a coalition with David Cameron.
No, I would not in any way begrudge people who want to not exactly make life uncomfortable for him, but express in our free democratic country what they think of him. And I'd much rather see kind of robust exchanges, people demonstrating if they want to and all that kind of stuff. So I think I'd be quite hardline in making sure that people have the right to do that. I really hope there isn't heavy-handed treatment of demonstrators against Trump and so on. But I think to say he just shouldn't come at all is not something I would say.
He went to Paris, of course, on Bastille Day, the red carpet.
And his great new friend, Macron.
His great new friend. And it was very interesting. I mean, I didn't see any protests in France at all. I mean, mind you, the CRS in France do deal with protests more than we would. And there is, you know, Macron now, and he's been in America, and it's been a very successful trip, and they appear to be great mates, this bromance that's happening. I mean, shouldn't it really be Theresa May that was having the first state visit to America?
Well, I think it is obvious to me, particularly if you look at the almost cloying body language between Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump, that Macron is very deliberately and very purposefully seeking to position himself exactly where British prime ministers traditionally were. He wants to be the go-to person in Europe for the Americans. Now, you and I would disagree with this. I think that is his choice, but also, frankly, one of the inevitable consequences of the diminution of British influence because of Brexit. But for example, I read somewhere, I don't know whether this is true, that there were repeated telephone calls, multiple telephone calls between Trump and Macron before the military action taken by the French, the Americans and the British in Syria just recently. Far more conversations than Trump had with Theresa May. Yeah. Even in my time in office, it would be simply unthinkable that a US president would turn to a French president before and more intensely than they do towards a British prime minister. You and I will disagree on this. I think that is the sign of the times, that Britain simply isn't as relevant to American calculations now that we are weakening our own position in Europe.
If you talk to this administration, and you know, I know John.
The
Trump,
US administration.
Yeah, I know.
But will you see Trump when he comes here? Or?
Trump. Well, I saw him recently. I saw him recently back in March and spoke to him. But, I mean, be in no doubt that the Trump administration is a pro-Brexit administration. I think it's got anything to do with the fact, personally, that Macron is the leader of an EU country. I think, basically, Trump is someone who wants to be treated with respect, because he's kind of been quite used in the last couple of years to being slagged off by virtually everybody. I think the British have missed a chance, and I agree with you. I think, actually, the special relationship for the next couple of years may well shifted.
But Trump doesn't feel that May has treated him disrespectfully, and therefore he's being chummier with Macron.
I think, you know, when you have the Leader of the Opposition, when you have the Mayor of London, when you have the Speaker of the House of Commons, when you even have a British Prime Minister criticising him for retweeting a retweet, I think that they are less than gruntled with us. But one thing that Trump is dead clear on is Brexit is good. Brexit is the right thing. Brexit points the way for
yet
the rest
another reason
of the
in
world.
My book. Yet another reason in my book why it's not such a good idea. But anyway, go on. Sorry,
so
I interrupt.
Do you actually think you can stop Brexit now?
Not me, of course, not me. Do
well,
I?
You're pretty
do,
important.
Do,
figure
I,
than
do
this.
I think in a free democratic country you are always, you should always be free? It's, I think it's the essence of democracy. It's of course what David Davis famously said, that a democracy that can't change its mind ceases to be a democracy. And given the huge difference between what the British people were promised Brexit would bring and what it is likely to bring, I think it is always important until, you know, until in a sense the process is exhausted, to retain the freedom, dare I say, to take back control sufficiently that you can reopen the issue if we judge that to be right. I mean, it's very...
It's ironic, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, people like you denied us having a referendum for 40 years.
No,
and
no,
now
actually,
we've had one.
No,
and the Lib Dem policy
on this... No, actually, I used to be criticised for advocating a referendum.
The Lib Dem policy on this chopped and changed over the 25 years I've been involved.
Well,
there was no consistent message that came from the party at all. And it's those that most fiercely didn't want a referendum that now want a second one. Do you understand why there are millions of people out there that now view the political establishment with even more contempt than ever before?
Well, let me first correct you, of course. The Liberal Democrat position for certainly the last decade or more has been very simple, which is that if the United Kingdom enters into a new treaty with the European Union, which involves the relinquishing of significant new powers to the European, pooling of new powers to the European Union, that should be subject to a referendum. So much did we believe in that, and so consistent were we in that view, that we actually enshrined that in law during the coalition. So now, on the statute book, for the first time, there is a guarantee that in the event that the United Kingdom were to stay in the EU and we were to pool new powers, that would be a vote taken by the people, not by politicians. So I don't agree at all.
But you can change things without treaties in the European Union. They can happen by qualified majority votes.
Well,
they can happen through
primary
legislation.
What we were responding to,
as
you will remember, is that there was a 15-year period, if not more, of almost constant. And actually, I would argue, and who knows, maybe on this point you and I would have some point of agreement, I think there was almost excessive zeal for one treaty revision after the next, one new rewriting of the EU rules after the next. And so what I said, and what the Lib Dems said, and as I said, what we then enshrined in British law, and no other government did this, by the way, was to say, if that happens in the future, what I was against, of course, you're right, was the idea that you hold a referendum, as the Conservatives did, to settle an internal spat within the Conservative Party when there was no, in a sense, question to answer because there was no
But there was
treaty.
No internal. There may have been differences, but there was no prospect of Cameron losing a vote of confidence because Tory MPs were voting against him.
No, but this is where you, of course, played a very significant role. You freaked the Conservative Party out so much because of the then growth of the UK Independence Party. They thought, and who knows, you might, if you're a Conservative Party strategist, you might claim that you were successful, that the way to shoot UKIP's fox was to hold a referendum. All I'm saying is I object then and do now to the idea that you hold a referendum in effect to score political points within a party or between parties. What I've always believed is that there is selectively a case for referenda where big questions have to be
asked.
So
is that kind of, I mean, you know, 5 years you were there, Deputy Prime Minister with David Cameron, and we didn't see big splits in public or anything like that. But looking back on it, was that Cameron's worst mistake, calling that referendum?
Well, there was one mistake, of course, he made during my time in office. Because
he made the pledge during your time in office.
He made the pledge as a Conservative. He said, if I were to become Prime Minister in my own right,
yep,
in other words, if he was to dispense with the shackles and constraints of a coalition government, he would do so. He wasn't able to do so for 5 years because of the presence of the Liberal Democrats. So, in a sense, that wasn't really a great subject of debate because he knew he didn't have to ask. There was absolutely no remote way that we were going to help him settle his own internal party management issues by holding a referendum. But were there, well, no, I think to say that, you know, disagreements didn't spill into the open. Yes, they did, a whole bunch of things, from tax and spend to God knows what else, to education policy to environmental policy. On this one, there was a kind of peculiar, not peculiar, there was a kind of rather obvious gridlock, which is that the Conservative Party was becoming ever more, not least because of pressure from you, pulled in a what I would regard as an increasingly anti-European direction. And I sort of said, well, we're not going to allow this coalition government for 5 years, particularly because we had this big job of cleaning up the banking system and the public finances after the 2008 crash. I didn't want the coalition government to be engulfed by this obsession with Europe that I think parts of the British political and media elite have had for a long period of time, which actually most British people, some people are ferociously for, some people are ferociously against.
And we've settled it now. We've had a referendum, biggest exercise in democracy in the history of this country, and it's settled. We've voted to leave. We're leaving. 29th of March next year. We're leaving.
We're leaving if nothing changes. That's right. We will leave on the 29th of March at 11 p.m.
Yep.
Between now and then, of course, there is an important vote that MPs have to participate in, where they need to make a judgment about whether what's put before them in any way conforms to what their constituents legitimately have expected from Brexit, given all the utopian promises they were made at the time of the referendum. So I think there's several turns of the wheel before we get there. When you say, I mean, I hear this all the time. People keep saying the British people have voted. Let's remember the 16.1 million people who voted for a different outcome. Mm. And of course, the vast majority of young people in particular.
But that's
voted.
How we settle things.
No, it is.
General
it is.
That's how we do things. That's our system.
I agree. But unlike in general elections, what happens in general elections, boy, do I know this, is people vote for one lot. And then if they like what they do or don't like what they do, they then vote for them again or vote them out. It happened with me. I was up one moment and then booted out the next. This is rather different, is that people were asked to vote on the basis of all sorts of utopian propositions.
And they were told that we'd lose 800,000 jobs. We were told the economy would fall
by
4.6%. I mean, George Osborne, who was part of that government, you know, that you served 5 years in, George Osborne, through Project Fear, said the most abominable things would happen. No wonder David Cameron at Davos, when he talks off camera, says, look, I'm not happy about it, but hey, it's a mistake, not a disaster.
But I think in a democracy as well, the people who have to be held most responsible are the winners, not the losers. I mean, you can't really test...
But is Cameron right about that? You think it's a mistake to leave the European Union. Do you think it's a disaster?
I think whether it's a disaster or just a bad mistake, it depends, of course, on how we then act and how the EU does and so on. I personally think that by applying a very, what I would regard as very hard-line interpretation of a very narrowly won referendum result in which the country is deeply divided, particularly between young and old, and then impose upon that result this one-eyed interpretation of Brexit and says that, which says not only that we leave the political institutions of the EU, but also the customs union, also the single market. When, by the way, as recently as 2012, people like Liam Fox and David Davis were publicly saying they wanted to stay in the customs
union. But during the campaign, every single leading figure on the Leave and Remain side, including the £9 million that Cameron spent on a leaflet to go to every household, said, if you vote to leave, you leave the single market and you leave the customs union. And I look at the European Union since then. I mean, you and I had a debate, an LBC-sponsored debate back in 2014. It was a big event, you know. And one of the things that happened there, if you remember, perhaps you don't want to, but I
can't remember that debate.
I said one of the reasons for leaving is they were building a European army with an ambitious foreign policy, and I didn't want to be any part of that. You know, do you now accept that when you said that actually that was a dangerous fantasy, do you now accept there is an EU army just around the corner?
No, of course there isn't. And by the way,
Why are you in denial? I mean, I thought you loved the European Union. Why are you in denial? Such an army would help us design a common foreign and security policy. And, you know, when Juncker said those words, I was there. State of the Union speech. Hundreds of them, including all the Liberals, of course, standing up to attention. In fact, the Liberal group last week saying that we shouldn't be sending missiles into Syria with British flags on them and French flags, but the EU should be bombing Syria. Why? I mean, you love the European project. Why are you in denial about inevitably where it wants to go?
First thing is, you've got to get over this assumption that if someone believes that the European Union, on balance, and our membership of it is a good thing, does not believe that everything that emanates from Brussels is good. I believe in democracy, but I don't believe that everything that emanates from Westminster is a good thing either. So I think this rather... I believe to be rather extreme and simplistic interpretation that if you believe that Britain's role is in the European Union, therefore you are uncritical of it, is patently false. I'm very critical. The first point. Second point is, let's remember, we have always, as the one of only two major military powers in the European Union, France and Britain are the only countries that really matter militarily in the European Union. Both countries have always, and certainly Britain have always insisted on having a veto on the deployment of
that's the other thing that Juncker
is
saying.
Here's but listen, the extraordinary thing is, by leaving, we now relinquish that veto. In a sense, you are exaggerating the importance of Jean-Claude Juncker. He has absolutely no authority whatsoever.
He's the European Commission president.
Yes, but the European Commission does not control the deployment of British troops. Never has, never will.
No, well, I tell you what. Everywhere in Brussels, they're terribly excited. I mean, would you vote to rejoin
by
a European
what?
Union? Would you rejoin a European Union that had no veto on foreign policy, including going to war, and a European army?
I would be very uncomfortable about joining or rejoining a European Union where we don't, and we don't have the right for ourselves to decide whether young British men and women go into harm's way in military action. And my own view, as I say, is that it was abundantly clear in all the 40 years that we were a member of the European community that notwithstanding whatever Luxembourg prime ministers or others might say, who come, by the way, bluntly from countries that got no meaningful military capacity themselves, it is very, very, it has always been very obvious to me the only powers that count are France and Britain. And the argument that folk like you make, I've never understood, is we basically were leading that whole debate about the degree to which the European Union should pool its kind of common and foreign security policy efforts. And in some areas, there's a great case for doing so. It's a nonsense, for instance, that the European continent as a whole spends more on its armed forces than China and Russia combined, and yet we get far fewer bangs for our bucks.
Looking back, Nick, I mean, you've been, let's say, 5 years deputy prime minister. There's nobody in the country with a bigger insight into the big beasts of the political world today. You know, you saw Theresa May; she was the Home Secretary. Mm. I mean, how was your relationship with her?
Sort of functional and polite, but not. I wouldn't say warm and. I mean, look, she's not quite like that.
Does she have a warm, humorous approach to anybody?
Let me describe it. So, at the cabinet table, this long table, Cameron used to sit, you know, one in the middle, and I used to sit opposite in the middle, and Theresa May sat to my right. The National Security Council, of which David Cameron was chair and I was vice chair, we used to meet once, sometimes twice a week. And then in addition to that, because there were so many disputes between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives on issues falling under her authority, from visa charges to so-called Snooper's Charter, she also used to come to my office, certainly for the last 2 or 3 years, very regularly to try and thrash things out. I always found her polite, correct, hardworking, but she may have changed, but I didn't find... I mean, look, many politicians I know, even those I don't agree with, have an appetite for ingenuity. And for, you know, they want to try out new stuff. It's one of the reasons they go into politics. What I always found so striking about Theresa May was that how incredibly reluctant she was to trust her own judgments, take a risk, take a decision, stick with it, stick her neck out. She always had to go back to the, you know, these curious special advisors she had around her. So, she was not a bad person. She was,
but not laugh a minute.
It was not. No, but you know, that's people are different and come in different shapes and sizes.
And Cameron, it's remarkable, I think, that you've served together for 5 years. Mm. You had disagreements, but actually, we didn't really see public wars. It was remarkable the way the thing was held together.
Yes, it certainly was held together more than, of course, I remember, you'll remember it as well. I remember when we formed the coalition, all these portentous commentators would write these.
Yeah.
Spill a lot of ink in the British newspaper. Oh, I give this 4 weeks, I give it 4 months. And I kept saying to people, no, of course we'll stick to this. A, for a high-minded reason, because the country needs it, because we were just recovering from this appalling sort of heart attack in our financial system in 2008. And secondly, because frankly, we both had an interest as political parties to see it through for 5 years.
And does David Cameron keep in touch with you now?
I think I saw him a couple of months ago, but we're not. I mean, I know the whole Rose Garden thing.
We've talked about Trump and Macron.
By the way, Macron,
I mean, had
Trump,
nothing on the Rose Garden,
well,
did it?
No,
I mean, please.
I think the Rose Garden had nothing on Macron and Trump.
I don't agree.
I think they would enjoy a sunned up
You
moment.
Appeared to be a partnership of equals. No, I mean, David Cameron didn't pick a speck of dandruff off your jacket,
No, he certainly didn't. But the thing that I think perhaps people don't realise is that whilst, of course, we sought to be civil and so on, it was right from the beginning a very, very tough transaction. Of course it was. And we had to kind of thrash out our differences constantly, and often it would get very heated. But I think both of us judged, I certainly did, that if we spent all our time hanging out our dirty linen in public and saying, you know, I said this, he said that, and so on and so forth,
it would have been a catastrophe.
Well, as it happens, we got criticised, or I particularly got criticised in the end, that there was too much of that by the end, too much, the sort of argy-bargy of the coalition. But I think on the whole, most British people expect their governments just to get on with it and don't want to hear all the time about
rather
what
like,
goes on behind
like
closed
Brexit,
doors.
Brexit, really, which is why 70% of the population say just get on
boom,
with
boom.
It.
Boom, boom, that was a smooth...
But maybe, just maybe, there's a big change coming, because we saw a story the other week. Simon Franks, Labour Party donor, talking about getting 50 million quid together for a new centre party to, and I wish they hadn't really used this phrase, break the mould of Westminster politics.
I remember that.
So is this the kind of thing that you'll be leading soon?
Look, I'm very sceptical that you can, and by the way, break the mould, I think, was the phrase which was literally emblazoned
exactly
on old Liberal Party conference stages. I'm very sceptical that it's possible to turn up at the political races, however big the cheque that you have in hand, and sort of declare that you can sort of, you know, reinvent things from top to bottom. I am much more inclined to think that, in keeping with British political history, as you'll know, the big changes, the big sort of tectonic shifts in politics normally happen when you have major convulsions within existing political parties.
Yeah.
And I suspect the biggest fault line, which still remains to be kind of played out, if I can put it like that, is within the Labour Party.
Because you've got New Labour and Corbyn's Labour.
Exactly. If you've got a big constituency, a ready-made army, if I can put it like that, of women and men in the
Labour Party. But if a lot of those Labour men and women who are MPs, who are much more of a, say, liberal disposition, who is the great liberal standard bearer? Who's the person they could potentially... Is it Vince Cable?
I think it would come from within those Labour ranks, actually.
Oh, so it wouldn't be Vince?
Vince is the leader of the Liberal Democrats. He's busy enough leading one political party as it is. We're talking now about who...
But surely the Liberal Democrats have to be part of this new enterprise.
Well, I think the Liberal Democrats would, on the whole, I'm sure this might... You know, there might be some exceptions to this, would look at whether any sort of shift in the British landscape might actually be able to further big liberal aims like meaningful political reform, genuinely breaking the mould. By the way, very simple. You cannot break the mould in this country unless you break the stranglehold of the old-fashioned duopoly who've got this whole thing sewn up neatly. They've got the electoral arrangements, the party funding arrangements,
the patronage of the House. Postal voting,
all
the
of it.
So electoral reform is needed.
I would say to the
4 million votes.
No.
One seat.
We both take an insurgent view of this, at least. And I think I would say to the Liberal Democrats, if it ever were to be the case that the Liberal Democrats as a party had to ask whether they were going to join forces with a new entity, ask them beyond all the obvious questions about economic policy, European policy, environmental policy, are they genuinely committed to breaking the
way... Do you know Simon Franks?
I met him once, about a year ago, I think, first.
But he's...
Look, I just don't think... Look, everyone should... It's a free country. I think there are about over 30 new parties which have been registered.
But everyone can have a go. But they're led by people who no one's ever heard of. You're a former Deputy Prime Minister. I mean, you know, if it was...
I come with baggage.
Don't we all?
Don't we all?
But if you thought you could stop Brexit, you might just go for it.
Oh, look... I am very lucky. I had close to 20 years in elected politics. I was 5 years. For 5 years, I was, you know, co-running the British government. The thing that I care about right now more than anything else, as much as a sort of dad to young children who I want to grow up in a country which I think is outward facing and properly leading in our own hemisphere, in our own continent, not kind of, you know, off on some sort of utopian fantasy in the middle of the Atlantic. If I could do anything to make that come about, I would. At the moment, what I do is I speak both publicly and privately.
It's not impossible. No.
Not
impossible that you could come back in some way if you could make those things happen.
I really, really doubt it. I don't think you... I doubt these things. But right now, I think there's so much movement in British politics and the kind of earthquake which you helped to detonate, if I put it like that, of Brexit, I think will have aftershocks for a long, long period of time in British politics.
If not that, is it the European Commission for you next?
Hardly.
Could it be Paul Clegg? Could you come back to Nick Ferrari maybe on LBC?
I think we had great fun as it was, but I think we're not going to. The old band, I don't think, is going to regroup.
Nick Clegg, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to leave a review or comment, or both. Make sure you subscribe to Farage Against the Machine.